Voilà, donc bonjour à tous et soyez les bienvenus pour cette nouvelle séance du séminaire Heredia. Nous nous réjouissons d'accueillir aujourd'hui Alvin Jackson, qui vient de relativement loin et que nous remercions chaleureusement pour sa présence ici parmi nous. Nous allons certainement vivre un moment très instructif et sans plus attendre, je laisse la parole à notre modératrice Anne-Catherine de Bouvier.
Bonjour à tous, donc merci d'être là. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Alvin Jackson, who is Richard Lodge Professor of History at the University of Edinburgh, for this more than topical conference on the origins of Irish partition. This is of course topical for aggregation students, of which there is a significant group today. And I must thank Professor Jackson very much for his dedication to aggregation students over the past 18 months, in spite of strikes, yellow vests, travel hazards, and no end of travel complications. All of you will leave this conference having learned stuff, having a deeper understanding of issues, and will feel more confident. This is, of course, also topical in the current context of Brexit. Indeed, over the past years, many people, and not only in France, it seems, were puzzled to discover the existence of a potential Northern Ireland problem. Whence that situation originated is certainly one of the riddles that shall be solved today. I'm also personally very happy, not only as Head of Studies for Aggregation in Caen. For one thing, I've met Alvin on several academic occasions over the past year or so, and I'm really looking forward to his presentation. Then I remember reading one of his books back in the year 2000, that was Ireland 1798-1998, Politics and War, which I'd read as a gush of fresh air, and which had provided me not only with insight into particular matters, but also with food for thought, which I occasionally share with research students. I'd like to quote from the preface: the volume addresses some of the contemporary predicaments of Northern Ireland and the island as a whole. There's no grand narrative, however, no official story, but rather an interest in what Richard Kearney has called, quote, an open plurality of stories, unquote. The work embodies no blind faith in the canonical facts of Irish history. As Peter Novick has argued, the historian, and emphatically the Irish historian, can hope at best for plausibility, and I think that's something to meditate upon. And further subject of meditation, there are Salieri's here as well as Mozart's. I leave you to ponder that over the weekend, perhaps. So I'd hoped to invite Professor Jackson for one of our Irish Studies conference here in Caen, but that had not been practicable then. So I'm really, really glad Alvin is here with us today between a conference here and a conference there next week in Switzerland. It would be preposterously long to embark upon a list of his works. Many of you are already familiar with them. And among others, Home Rule and Irish History 1800-2000, published in 2003. The Two Unions, Ireland, Scotland and the Survival of the United Kingdom, 1707-2012. And recently, Judging Redmond and Carson in 2018. Alvin Jackson also edited the Oxford Handbook of Modern Irish History. Alvin Jackson is also the author of many articles, mainly on the subject of union and unionism, and lately, if I gathered correctly, he started to turn his attention to a comparative approach of union states across 19th century Europe, and in particular, if I remember correctly, Austria-Hungary. But Alvin is here to tell us today about revisiting the origins of Irish partition. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anne-Catherine. Thank you, first of all, for permitting me to speak in English. But I'm also I'm also greatly honoured to be here. Anne-Catherine, as she has said, invited me here 20 years ago, almost. So it has taken me 20 years to come here. I was very distressed at that time not to be able to, for different reasons not to be able to come to Caen, but I am delighted and honoured to have gotten here eventually. I'm speaking, as Anne-Catherine has said, on the issue of Irish partition. And this is appropriate, I think, because there is a Brexit dimension to the whole question of the Irish border, it is true. This is also the centenary year of Irish partition, so it is perhaps an appropriate moment to pause and think about the origins of this enterprise, as well as its subsequent fallout. And I suppose if I can summarise at least some of the thoughts that I'm going to be offering you in the course of the next 50 minutes or so, I would say that we tend to think of partition as an event. So we're thinking about this as the centenary year of partition. And I would encourage you to think of it not so much as a single event, which happened with the Government of Ireland Act. Those of you who are working on the Agregación will have studied the Government of Ireland Act and the partition legislation of 1920. I would encourage you, rather than to think in those terms, to think instead of partition as a dynamic. And I'll explain what I mean by that in the course of the lecture. And also, I think many of us have looked at partition as essentially the product of what British Conservatives and Irish Unionists sought in their engagement with Home Rule politics between 1910 and 1920. That partition, in essence, was an expression of conservatism and unionism. And what I'm going to be proposing over the next 50 minutes is a slightly different take upon that. I will be suggesting that the origins of partition are layered, that the origins are multiple, and we should spend some time in trying to excavate those different layers. So how precisely am I going to proceed? So here is a huge array of questions. I won't probably be able to get through all of them, but I will try. I want to begin with to say a little bit about essentially the chronology of partition between 1885 and 1920. And the purpose of this is to remind some of you who may have studied this issue a while ago and who need reminding, but also perhaps to give a simple chronological structure to those of you for whom this theme is less familiar. I want to take a look as well at the wider issue of borders and partitions in the early 20th century. We in Ireland, as well as those of us who work in the United Kingdom, we all of us still work within our national silos, historiographically speaking. And yes, within modern history, there has been something of a transnational turn. But that transnationality, I don't think, has affected every part of our discipline and every subject. And there is a strong transnational dimension to this question of borders and partitions. I want to ask why there was an Ulster question. I want to think about what unionists wanted with partition. As Anne-Catherine has very kindly said, I've been working on John Redmond and Carson for a recent book, and I'll say something about Sir Edward Carson, who is the Irish unionist leader, and his view of partition, but I'm also going to say something about British liberals and British conservatives, British Tories, and partition. I'm going to suggest to you that partition, as it emerges in the early 1920s, is in a sense an example of the law of unintended consequences. And this takes me back to the point that I was seeking to make at the very beginning, which is that we think of 1920 as the beginning of Irish partition, or if you like, 1912, 1914, as the start of something that ends in 1920. But I think it's important to understand that The border that is instituted in Ireland in 1920 is very, very, very different from that which is envisioned in 1912, 1914. None of those who are debating in 1912, 1914 expect that by the 1920s and beyond, there will be the creation of, in effect, an international frontier. What they are expecting is a border between two different polities within the British world. And I'll explore that in greater detail, as I say, shortly. And lastly, I'm very keen on this idea of partition as import-export. Partition shouldn't be seen exclusively in an Irish context or a British context. It has to be seen globally, because there are influences that bring partition into Ireland and affect international influences which affect its shape in Ireland, just as partition doesn't stay in Ireland. It is, in a sense, an export product. So I've said a great deal about what I'm going to say. I better actually turn to the agenda itself. So let me just go through the chronology of partition very, very quickly, just to jog memories and to provide a framework for those for whom this may be territory which is less understood or whom you may be encountering in some cases for the first time. So in 1885, there is the beginnings of a revolution in British politics. British Liberal Prime Minister William Gladstone announces that he is abandoning a lifetime of support for the unions of the United Kingdom, and he is embracing the idea of home rule for Ireland. That is to say, the idea of actually quite limited self-government for Ireland, which mainstream Irish nationalism has been propounding from at least the early 1870s with Isaac Butt, and arguably for much of the 19th century. I think we have to go beyond this as a simple kind of piece of chronology. What this says is the union is flexible. What this says is that change is possible. What this also says is that, of course, Britain does not have a codified constitution. Britain does not have a codified constitution like the French. And therefore, constitutional change is dependent upon a relatively simple mechanism, that is to say, a parliamentary majority. Home Rule is introduced in 1886, and the fallout from the introduction of Home Rule is, as many of you will recall, that the measure is defeated. It's defeated in the House of Commons, but the politics of the United Kingdom for a generation are defined by Home Rule. If you support Home Rule in Britain, in England or Scotland or Wales, you can't be a Conservative. You have to be a Liberal. Because the dividing line in British politics is on this national question. So essentially, at the risk of a dangerous generalization or piece of reductionism, I think it is possible to suggest that the politics of the United Kingdom for this generation are determined by the two questions or principles of nationality and class. Not so very different, actually, from the situation in continental Europe. Not so very different, in fact, from, Anne-Catherine was mentioning, the dual monarchy, Austria-Hungary. 1893, the second Home Rule Bill is defeated, in the House of Lords this time. And what this suggests is that democratic reform to the British Parliament the reduction of the powers, or the potential reduction of the powers of the upper house, the aristocratic and landed house within the British Constitution. Democratic reform implies now the success of Home Rule. And 1911, as you will recall, there's a major constitutional reform. The House of Lords is weakened. April 1912, a third Home Rule Bill is introduced. And with the introduction of Home Rule, for this third time, its possibilities are much, much greater than hitherto. And partition, the idea of partition, also is linked with this, I think, democratization of British parliamentary politics. We'll return to that thought in a moment. July 1914 sees the Buckingham Palace Conference on Home Rule with the representatives of Irish nationalism, John Redmond, John Dillon, the representatives of unionism, Edward Carson, James Craig, King George V, the British Prime Minister, Asquith. And discussion by this stage in the Home Rule debate is focusing increasingly on the idea of, yes, partition, yes, a specific form of partition, six counties, the six northeastern counties of Ireland. This map dates from 1920 and looks as if it dates from 1920. So you see Northern Ireland in the top corner of the island of Ireland. The division, however, is between nationalists who say, led by John Redmond, who say that this partition has to be temporary, and unionists who want it to at least look as if it is permanent. Home Rule is delayed with the introduction of the First World War, and that relegation is absolutely critical because it feeds into a radicalization of Irish politics. 1914-1918 is frequently seen as a war between empires. It's been described as a war against the concept of empire. And following the logic of that, the United Kingdom, as a form of internal empire as well as a polity with overseas dominions, overseas colonies, the United Kingdom is undermined fatally and constitutionally in 1914-1918. And the Irish War of Independence and, if you like, the partial breakup of the United Kingdom in 1921-1922 can be seen, I think, alongside the disruption of other European empires. The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland in the early 1920s loses more European territory than the German Empire does, the defeated German Empire, because of Irish independence in 1921-1922. So Home Rule is dramatically relegated in terms of British priorities. The First World War places huge pressures upon the liberal values of the British state, just as the First World War places huge values, places huge pressure upon the liberal content of other continental European states, again, like the Habsburg territories. And that, I think, tension between the war and the values of the state, I think, is profoundly subversive. And for the United Kingdom, it's profoundly subversive in terms of Ireland. In terms of the history of partition, 1916 sees a return to the idea of six-county partition, temporary or permanent. 1918 sees evidence now of this ongoing radicalisation of Irish politics with the huge electoral victory for Sinn Féin, which signals the transition of nationalist Ireland towards a more radical and separatist national set of national feelings. And December 1920 sees a last effort on the part of the British to see through the politics of the pre-war period by passing the Government of Ireland Act, a measure which returns to the pre-war notion of home rule, but now applies it to both parts of Ireland, the north and the south, the six counties which had originally been designated as remaining inside the United Kingdom and under the direct control of London. They now have their own small parliament in Belfast. And subsequent events effectively see the consolidation of this scheme. In the south of the island, the Irish Revolution means that the form of home rule the British are proposing in 1920 has been overtaken by full-blooded independence, albeit within the British Empire. A boundary commission in the mid-1920s essentially confirms the county-based division that had been laid down in 1920. And in 1949, Ireland becomes a republic and leaves the British Commonwealth. And I put this in as part of the chronological sweep because partition is now not as it had started out in 1912, about different polities within a reconstituted United Kingdom, each looking still to a sovereign Westminster. Partition now, in the 1940s, is about an international frontier between the United Kingdom and an independent republic resting beyond, at least formally and constitutionally, the British world. Right, that's enough of the revision session on Home Rule. Let me turn to my next question, which is, why was there an Ulster question? So the idea of the North, the Northern Province, Ulster, as being different is an idea which feeds into, this cultural idea feeds into the politics of partition in 1910, 1920. So let me again remind you of some of the background to this a little bit. So the north of Ireland is associated very quickly with a distinctive history of British, English and Scots migration and colonisation. Other parts of the island of Ireland have a history of an English presence, but not with the same intensity as the northeast of the island. In the northeast of the island, there is an extensive formal colonization process or plantation process beginning in the early 17th century. And it's tied in with contemporary metropolitan ideas, government ideas about the development of Britishness and the British realm. Plantation of Ulster coincides with the union of the Royal Union, the union of the thrones of England and Scotland, and the consolidation of a sense of Britishness. And what is being undertaken in Ireland in the first decade of the 17th century is a British project. To use the phrase of one of my Irish history colleagues at University College Galway, making Ireland British through migration and colonization. This presence in the northeast is associated ultimately with the politics of unionism at the end of the 19th century, with the idea of support for a closer constitutional relationship between Ireland and Britain. But it's important, I think, to bear in mind that unionism is not exclusive to the northeast. There is a southern Irish unionism as well, and I'll come back to that point also. Irish unionism is associated with the industrialization of the northeast. The northeast is the part of Ireland which is most comprehensively industrialized and most comprehensively incorporated into the British industrial economy of the 19th century. The rates of urban growth in Belfast are mirrored by other Victorian boom towns like Glasgow, or in terms of the north of England, Newcastle or Liverpool. but are unusual in the context of the island of Ireland itself. So an economy develops in the Northeast which looks to, for capital as well as markets, the rest of the United Kingdom and the wider British Empire. And that too feeds into the politics of unionism. I think that the political growth of unionism, which again is connected very closely to the partition question, is connected with the democratisation of Irish politics. So, and the democratisation of British politics more generally. So there are reform acts extending the parliamentary franchise in 1867. The secret ballot is introduced in 1872. For the first time, you vote in secret. Before that, before 1872, you vote in public, and you're therefore subject to the influence of landlords, industrial employers, if as a working man, and it's an exclusively male franchise, of course, before 1918, you have the vote. And there's a further parliamentary reform in 1884, 1885, and all of this consolidates the proponents of home rule. But it also means that unionism is increasingly focused in the northeast of the island, because property unionists elsewhere, who had landed unionists, land and southern unionism go hand in hand. Professional upper middle class wealth and southern unionism go hand in hand. And the more you democratize British and Irish politics, the more the electoral influence of those southern unionists is reduced, and the more the democracy of the Northeast is heightened. The decline of landed political influence also feeds into this increasing importance of the North within unionism. And there's the cultural celebration at this time of a distinctive planter tradition, a distinctive tradition of, in particular, the Scots' presence in the north of Ireland. So I think from all of these different elements, there emerges an Ulster question, a question of a group within the northeast of Ireland, distinguished in a variety of ways by religion, by perceptions of ethnicity, distinct from Catholic, Gaelic, nationalist Ireland. But crucially, before 1913, this does not create in itself a popular demand for separate treatment. Before 1913, 1914, this distinctive set of political developments in the north of the island do not feed into any specific case for regional differentiation, politically speaking. Okay. Let's widen the horizons a little bit. So I suggested at the beginning of my talk that I wanted to think a little bit about some of the international context of partition. Let me begin a little bit to fulfill that promise. I think understanding partition or exclusion, exclusion is another word for partition, the exclusion of the north of Ireland from home rule. Understanding partition requires some sense of the wider imperial and international context of the time. Partition is fundamentally about drawing a border. And I would suggest to you that this is an age of empire. Towards the end of the period and beyond, it's you're getting into the age of decolonization. And I would suggest to you that imperial expansion as well as decolonization are accompanied by the proliferation of borders and the establishment of frontiers. So analogies between this British colonization of the north of Ireland and the French colonial experience in North Africa are sometimes made. And there are points of comparison and there are points of contrast. But the French colonial the French colonial empire in Africa requires the establishment often of intricate, complex frontiers, as the British Empire does. And the process of decolonization brings those frontiers into renewed consideration. So we're talking about a period when globally frontiers are center stage. So in terms of the immediate backdrop to Irish partition, the British are negotiating a frontier between Alaska and Canada, less than 10 years before partition becomes center stage as a theme within Irish politics. One of those negotiating the frontier between British North America and the United States is Sir Edward Carson, the Irish Unionist leader. And I think that's important for reasons that I'll explain shortly. Britain is practicing partition, not just in Ireland in this period, but also in terms of India. There is a hugely controversial partition of the greatly important province, northeastern province of the British Empire in India, Bengal, which essentially is divided between, under the viceroyalty of Lord Curzon, between a Muslim section, which is in the east, and a Hindu section in the west. This partition fails partly because of Hindu nationalist protest. And it's rescinded, it's abandoned in 1911. And I think this hugely important event in terms of the British imperial world has to be taken into account when you look at Ireland. And I'll try to suggest some of the importance of this for Ireland in a moment. Partition, in a sense, is an issue in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's certainly a big issue with the successor states when Central Europe is broken up into supposedly nation states in the aftermath of 1918-1919. But even during the kind of the heyday of the Habsburg Empire, the dual monarchy, partition in the sense of cultural and ethnic frontiers and the defining of those frontiers is an everyday part of the politics of that empire. And this is not just a kind of detached comparison. Austria-Hungary and other of these multinational union kingdoms are studied by the British proponents of home rule extremely closely indeed. So Gladstone, if you know anything about the British Liberal Prime Minister, the hero of Home Rule, William Gladstone, you know that he would be a disaster in terms of 21st century politics. He would be a disaster in terms, certainly, of 21st century British politics because he reads books. He thinks. He reads political philosophy. He's very spiritual. He has a very strong sense of personal faith and spirituality, and a very strong sense of providentialism in his own life and more widely. But he combines that with an intense intellectualism, and he does his homework over Home Rule. He looks to Vienna, he looks to Sweden, Norway, which is a united kingdom at this time. He looks to Canada. I talked about the frontier between Canada and Alaska. So the tensions, cultural and ethnic, in other polities are not irrelevant to the Irish case when it comes to a consideration of home rule and partition. And then, of course, there's the whole question of boundaries and plebiscites after the First World War. The deciding of a boundary in Ireland is only part of a complicated wider European settlement which involves plebiscites and boundary decisions throughout the what I'll crudely call the German world, the kind of the world or sphere of influence of the defeated German Empire. So in the north, on the borders of Denmark, there is a plebiscite in Schleswig. In the south east of the German Empire, bordering Poland, there is a plebiscite in Silesia. In terms of Austria-Hungary, there is a plebiscite in Carinthia, in the south of what becomes the German-Austrian Republic, differentiating it from what emerges as Yugoslavia. The Irish border is part of a network of border definitions. The establishment of new frontiers stretching across Europe, there is a difference. There is no plebiscite in Ireland. And there is no plebiscite in Ireland, in contradistinction to Schleswig, Silesia, Carinthia, for the simple reason that the British are victors in the First World War, and the Austro-Hungarians and the Germans are not. Right, let's think about unionists and partition. What do they want? What do they not want? So, I have said unionist partition and the 1886 Home Rule Bill, no. Let me explain what I mean by that. What I mean by that is actually nothing particularly complicated. Home Rule is discussed very extensively in 1886. Unionists do not ask for partition in 1886. The Liberals, who are proposing Home Rule in 1886, are, if you have been wise enough to read my Home Rule book, you will see some evidence in that Home Rule book of homework on the part of the Liberals quietly on the issue of the potential division of Ireland. So the Liberals are beginning to think about contingency planning. I wouldn't put it any more heavily than that. Contingency planning in 1886. Unionists are not asking for partition. They're not asking for partition in 1893. They still see Ireland as a unit. They still see their own politics as essentially unitary. And I think there is a parallel to be made here, possibly with Muslim politics in India. So the idea of a separate Muslim nation, Pakistan, only develops slowly. The idea of a separate unionist and largely Protestant Ireland, Northern Ireland, only develops slowly and incrementally. This takes me back to the point that I sought to make about a dynamic in this process. It isn't that somebody thinks of the idea of partition and applies it. Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who is effectively the founder of modern Pakistan, comes to the idea of partition very late in life, like Edward Carson. For most of each of their lives, they think of the territory that they're dealing with in unitary terms. So unionists in 1886 and 1893 think of Ireland as a unit. Part of the key reason for this is that unionism in 1886 and 1893 is Irish unionism. It's an island phenomenon. There is a unionism in Dublin and in a minority sense in other major Irish cities. There are numbers, there is strength of population in the north,
But there is still this money and influence in the South and West. So unionism in 1886 and 1893 is about maintaining a link between all of Ireland and the United Kingdom. Unionists shift in 1913 to the idea of nine-county partition, which is almost certainly tactical, a way of wrecking home rule. And by 1914, the debate, as I said at the very beginning of my talk, has focused on the idea of six counties, and that remains the position until the actual establishment of Northern Ireland in 1920. All this leads me to consider what the leader of Irish unionism at this time, this gentleman, Sir Edward Carson, pictured here in Belfast in 1914, what he actually wants. So, insofar as you have encountered this individual in your agrégation and other studies, it will be as almost certainly as a unionist, a supporter of union, and a supporter of partition. And that is absolutely correct. Sir Edward Carson supports union and he supports partition. Except that we have to get beyond that a little bit, I think. First of all, those of you who don't know who Carson is, I've just said that he's the leader of Irish unionism. He is not just the leader of Irish unionism, he's the most important, he's the most celebrated British lawyer of his generation, I think it is fair to say. So he's involved in all sorts of high-profile cases. He's involved, for those of you who are students of Irish literature, he's involved in the first of the Oscar Wilde cases. He has a complicated relationship with Wilde. For those of you who are, I don't expect that this will be the case, who are interested in kind of second league English drama, there is a dramatist called Terence Rattigan who produced a play and a film called The Winslow Boy. Winslow Boy is a kind of sentimental drama about a youngster who's training to be a naval officer who is accused of theft and who takes his case to court against the British government, the Admiralty, the British Navy Ministry. And his lawyer is Edward Carson. It's one of the most celebrated cases of the Edwardian period in Britain. 1910, and Carson is involved with this. So Carson is not just a kind of obscure Irish politician, he's center stage in terms of the British courts at this time. He's also seen as, to quote one of his biographers, as the man who divided Ireland. In other words, the kind of father figure of partition. And there's a strong and entirely reasonable case for seeing him in those terms. Except that when you excavate with Carson, as I've had to do for a recent biography, there are some very strange pieces of evidence which come to the surface. So I've given you three quotations there, which we can perhaps get these slides onto your website so that you can look at these in a more leisurely way after this class. Carson says in 1925, or circa 1925, looking back at politics, I think we made a great mistake in not accepting Mr. Gladstone's first Home Rule Bill. Looking back at politics, I think we made a great mistake in not accepting Mr. Gladstone's first Home Rule Bill. So this is Carson, the kind of the patriarch of unionism. I am a citizen without nationality or anything to be loyal to. This is Carson, the kind of super unionist. I think there'd be more decency in a republic than in this humbug, by which he means, humbug means hypocrisy. I think there'd be more decency in a republic than in this humbug, by which he means the halfway house of the Irish Free State, the position of Ireland having a substantial grant of independence but within an imperial framework. In fact, I'd rather see a republic. So So I think what I would suggest to you can be summarized by the title of this next slide, that Carson's political evolution can be seen as moving from partition as a tactic through partition as a compromise to, as politicians do, reinventing his own career as being all about partition, partition as a goal. But the reality is that Carson is a Dubliner. He's not from the north. He doesn't have a strong personal and familial connection, family connection with the north of Ireland. Remember, we talked about the boundary between Alaska and Canada. This is a very difficult negotiation. It's about establishing a very complex frontier. Carson's involved with the detail and the fights over that. And the simple message that I take away from this is that he can be in no doubt about the complexity of drawing boundaries, because he's had experience of it. We talked earlier about the failed partition of Bengal. Carson and the militant Ulster Unionists of 1910-1914 have very strong connections with the British imperial presence in India. Carson has a brother who is in the British Army in India, a senior officer in the British Army in India. The failure of partition in an Indian context is known to Unionists in 1910-1914, like Carson. Carson adopts partition as a tactic in 1911-1912 because he wants to use it to wreck home rule. One of the central principles, one of the central tenets of Irish nationalism, and in particular the nationalism of John Redmond, is the unity of the island. John Redmond, whom you will have been studying in class, John Redmond's career is built upon the disastrous divisions within nationalism of the 1890s after Parnell's death. And he sees it as his, and he too is a very religious man, and he too sees a sense that his purpose politically is to sustain unity, the unity of the Irish national movement, but the unity of the island as well. Carson understands this, and partition for him is, at least to begin with, a wrecking tactic. He deploys this in the hope that Redmond will retreat from his most advanced positions over home rule to something lesser. By 1913, he's accepting partition as a compromise. And you can see, reading his correspondence in that year, a dramatic shift in his outlook. And eventually, with the creation of the Northern Irish state, at least in 1920, at least publicly, he's looking back on all this as inevitable. But inevitable it's not. Where Carson is at least publicly in the 1920s, is very different from where he is 10, 15 years before. And here is the front cover of this marvelous book that that Anne-Catherine was referring to. Carson in cartoon form on the right, nose to nose with John Redmond on the left. And it's a quotation from Carson from 1911. Northeast Ulster is the key to the situation, but the government dare not propose separate treatment, and Redmond could not accept it. So evidence for this Carson view of partition as a wrecking tactic. Now, I'm going to deal very quickly with British liberals and partition, and even more quickly with British conservatives and partition. I've said a little bit already about John Redmond and the theme of unity in his particular career, and in his vision of parliamentary nationalism. I think what I want to say under this heading is very simply that liberals think about partition for quite a long time. All of you quite rightly understand, I hope, that liberals, British Prime Minister H.H. Asquith and his Liberal government resist partition, so they do. But they are also privately debating all of the what-ifs, the contingencies. What do we do if? And they've been doing this from 1885, 1886. And the points that I'm seeking to make on the overhead are that Gladstone, when he actually starts thinking about partition, is looking at European analogies where there are complicated cultural and ethnic frontiers between different peoples. You can't look at Austria-Hungary without seeing that. H.H. Asquith, the Prime Minister, as a very junior lawyer in 1885, 1886, is involved with some contingency planning over a possible separate northern division within Home Rule. Augustine Birrell, who is the British minister responsible for Ireland in this period, also talks about the idea of county option, the idea that individual counties would vote whether to be on one side of the Home Rule divide or not. Winston Churchill, who in later life is a conservative and imperialist, at this time is the British Navy Minister, the Minister for the Navy. His official title is First Lord of the Admiralty. And he's talking about a federal arrangement within Britain and Ireland, dividing England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland into subsidiary units, each with their own assemblies. So he too is looking at least pragmatically at the idea of possible divisions in Ireland. Now, I'm not saying that liberals do anything other than resist partition. I am, however, saying that privately they look at the idea of dividing Ireland as a possibility, as a contingency. This is the British Prime Minister Asquith, speaking in 1912, writing in 1912 to King George V, if it becomes clear as the Home Rule Bill proceeds that some special treatment must be provided for the Ulster counties, the government will be ready to recognise the necessity. If it becomes clear as the bill proceeds that some special treatment must be provided for the Ulster counties, the government will be ready to recognise the necessity. I'm not going to dwell for too long on the Tories and partition because conservatism and partitionist thought go hand in hand. I've mentioned on the screen a variety of figures, intellectuals, newspaper editors, as well as the unionist leader, the conservative and unionist leader of the time, Andrew Bonar Law, who are all active partitionists. Strachey, the first of these names, is relatively unknown in terms of the intellectual and political history of the partition question. So I've dwelt a little bit upon him, and there's a slightly scary photograph of him that I have for you. Very bright-eyed. And he essentially is one of those who advocates within the highest levels of metropolitan politics the idea that there are two nations in Ireland. There are two different nations in Ireland. Now, that two nations philosophy, political philosophy, is not central to Irish unionism in 1893, 1886, but it gains much greater traction in 1910, 1914, and Strachey is one of its advocates. And one of the earliest works on this theme of two separate nations in Ireland, as opposed to regional variations of the one kind of Irish people, this idea of two nations is also being advocated in a book published in 1913 called The Two Irish Nations and written by a very senior British journalist, formerly of the Times newspaper, a man called Moneypenny. I'm not sure that I have that name for you. W.F. William Flavell Moneypenny, who wrote The Two Irish Nations in 1913. So I suppose what I'm saying is that through this period, the idea of two separate Irish nations gains greater traction and greater currency than hitherto. Strachey is one of its advocates. Moneypenny, writing in 1913, is another. I've talked a number of times in the course of my remarks about partition as being a dynamic event. And what I mean by this is illustrated on the overhead. So partition starts in 1916 as being about an administrative border between two polities, two territories, which would remain inside a reformed United Kingdom. Home rule in 1912 and afterwards, at least for those early years, is about a separate Irish assembly which has very curtailed powers and which is still subservient to Westminster. To begin with, in 1912-1913, the idea of a United Kingdom tariff union is still being maintained. So there's a degree of economic union that's still envisioned. And these two polities are still essentially within a reformulated United Kingdom. In 1920, the British proposal, the Government of Ireland Act, which is really behind the times because it's dealing with a situation which has long since been surpassed. It's dealing with a situation really prior to the rise of Sinn Féin and the radicalisation of Irish nationalism, the popularisation of Irish separatism. The British proposal, the Government of Ireland Act, suggests two home rule polities in Ireland still closely connected with London. So the division, again, is a softer division. But the Anglo-Irish War of 1919-1921, which is in effect resolved by the Anglo-Irish Treaty of December 1921, delivers an Irish Free State still within the British Empire, but largely independent and free to pursue, broadly speaking, its own economic policies. So the economic union of 1912 has now gone in 1921. The kind of rejigged United Kingdom that's envisioned in 1912 is now effectively replaced by a form of international frontier. And when Ireland withdraws from the British Commonwealth, and emerges for the first time formally as a republic in 1949, this now delivers, in effect, an international frontier between part of the United Kingdom and ostensibly a foreign country. So partition is an exceedingly complex story. When you discuss partition in 1912-1914, that is different from the partition which becomes effective in 1920-1921. And beyond that, with the consolidation of Irish sovereignty, with the consolidation of the sovereignty and the independence of the new Irish state, in some ways that boundary grows more complete. Now, the bad news that I have for you is that Anne Catherine has said that I can go beyond 1 hour in talking, but I won't go very far beyond 1 hour. I will give you 5 or 10 more minutes in the interests of humanity, but after 5 or 10 minutes, I will finish. So. There's only, I think, 2 or 3 more points to cover, and I'll do those as quickly as I possibly can. Partition, I've said, is a dynamic event. I'm not going to dwell upon this quotation, which is from a political geographer, an historical geographer called Kieran Rankin, but he offers, I think, a very interesting, if slightly wordy, verdict on the meaning of partition. But rather than kind of dwell on this now, I will post these slides on your departmental website and you can look that up subsequently. The quotation simply, I think, confirms the kinds of arguments or documents the kinds of arguments that I've been seeking to make. So, before coming to a conclusion, I want very quickly to think about partition as an Irish export product. One of the several themes of my talk today has been to urge upon you the notion that partition is not just about Ireland. You can't understand Irish partition if you don't look more widely at Europe and the British imperial world at the beginning of the 20th century. But remarkably, I think, from our point of view, partition is, in a sense, an export product. We generally regard Irish partition as highly controversial and on balance, deeply flawed. But for a period, it is seen as workable. And if you look, I suppose, at the world of the 1930s, with the rise of Nazism and fascism, the relatively stable set of polities of the United Kingdom looks quite good. So Ireland, in the sense of the Irish Free State, has emerged from a period of revolution and civil war as a relatively stable new polity. The partition arrangement is clearly a least worst option, but it appears to be in place. And the wider United Kingdom appears stable as well. And it's in these contexts that partition looks to be pliable in other contexts. It's in this set, or with this set of backdrops, that Indian Muslims think about the possibility of a partitioned Indian subcontinent with a Muslim home territory, which acquires the name of Pakistan. And Jinnah looks, whom we've mentioned already as the founding father of Pakistan, looks closely at the Irish analogy. And at this stage in the 1930s, there is nothing that he sees, at least in terms of his studies, as being discouraging from the application of this in an Indian context. Irish partition is also looked at in terms of the tension between Muslim and Jew in British-mandated Palestine in the 1930s and 1940s. And the idea of what is seen in the late 1930s as a relatively successful division of Ireland is broached as a possible example for a resolution to the religious and ethnic tensions within the British mandate in Palestine as well. So, summarizing this very quickly, in the 1930s, Irish partition is, in a sense, an export product. Just as I've suggested to you, there is an international context for the establishment of Irish partition to begin with. So, once established, it becomes a paradigm itself, and particularly, I think, so far as India and Palestine are concerned. These are pictures. Balfour, Arthur Balfour, who is a politician of Scots descent, is top left, massively embroiled in the politics of Irish unionism and Irish partition. This is him with one of the founders of Israel, Chaim Weizmann. And bottom right is Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who I think can be...
Pakistan?
Yes, indeed. Who can be linked with the politics of partition in Ireland, which to some extent he sees as possibly applicable within the Indian subcontinent. Exactly so. The conclusions you will be relieved to see. So, several bullet points trying to summarize what I've said. I'm suggesting to you that there is a complex imperial and international context to Irish partition. I've suggested to you that there's an Ulster question, that the North is different in some ways, but this doesn't automatically produce demands for partition before 1910, 1914. Edward Carson is in the title of one of his biographers, the man who divided Ireland. Yet it's absolutely clear that he moves from an all-Ireland unionism to treating partition as a tactic to wreck home rule, exploiting John Redmond's faith in unity, moving towards compromise, partition as a compromise, and then reinventing the idea of partition basically as a lifelong goal. British liberals oppose partition, but they think about it and they make contingency plans for it. And some liberals are softer on the idea of partition than others. Asquith, the Prime Minister, is supremely pragmatic. Lloyd George, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is also much more pragmatic and open to partition than some others. Partition is a dynamic. It's not static. It's not a single event. We are thinking about the centenary of partition today, but that centenary, that delivery in 1920, was not by any means an automatic event. We have to look at the role of contingency in all of this. Partition was both an import as well as an export product. This ties to the first of these points. It shouldn't be seen in isolation from continental Europe or from the British Empire. And I guess the last point is simply an open question. Do the arguments for Irish partition still stand? The arguments for Irish partition in 1912, 1914 were about religion and about the depth and intensity of religious division on the island of Ireland. They were about different views of society and the economy, the idea being that the North was more industrialized and more urbanized, the South and Southern nationalist politics more agrarian. But now in the 21st century, these religious divisions, so far as the South of Ireland are concerned, are infinitely less significant than they were than was the case 100 years ago. And Ireland, far from being the relatively underdeveloped agrarian economy of the years of union, is now one of the more successful economies within the European Union. So the question arises, therefore, do the arguments for Irish partition still stand? And with that open question, I'll end. Thank you.